You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation from 2012 with Vermont poet Jane Shore. We discussed her book, That Said, New and Collected Poems, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. In the second half of the show, I'll play a second interview from the archives with the author, Philip Graham. Jane Shore's poetry has garnered accolades from critics and prestigious awards in her field. She's the author of 6 books of poems: Eye Level, winner of the 1977 Juniper Prize; The Minute Hand, awarded the 1986 Lamont Prize; Music Minus One, a finalist for the 1996 National Book Critics Circle Award; Happy Family, a yes or no answer, winner of the 2010 Poets Prize; and That Said, New and Collected Poems. Jane Shore is the recipient of fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the Radcliffe Institute, the Hodder at Princeton University, the Goodyear Fellow at the Foxcroft School, and twice from the National Endowment for the Arts. She's a professor at the George Washington University and lives in Washington, D.C. and in Vermont. Since Robert Fitzgerald praised Eye Level, Jane Shore's 1977 Juniper Prize-winning first collection, for its, quote, cool but venturesome eye, her work has continued to receive the highest accolades and attention from critics and fellow poets. That Said, New and Selected Poems extends Shore's lifelong vivid exploration of memory, her childhood in New Jersey, her Jewish heritage, her adult years in Vermont, Shore's devotion to her familiar coterie of departed parents, aunts, uncles, and friends, passionately subscribes to Sholem Aleichem's dictum that eternity resides in the past. I began my interview with Jane Shore by asking about her background and the path that she took to become a writer. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
My background is that I grew up in North Bergen, New Jersey, over my parents' clothing store. They had a dress store. My father was a musician in the big bands in the 30s and 40s. Oh. And went to the Second World War. And then when he came back, when he married my mother, he found that there was no musical world anymore of the kind that he had had before, and especially if he wanted to have a family and not be on the road for however many weeks,
right,
a year. And so when he married my mother, they opened the store, and so I grew up over the store. And very New Jersey, North Bergen, Cold War, Jewish upbringing. And I went to Goddard College. Uh-huh. I fell in love with the song Moonlight in Vermont, which my father used to play on his saxophone and clarinet. And I thought, I just have to see that place to see whether or not it's really the way the song says it is.
And it's not.
It's exactly the way. No, I loved it. I love the song, and I thought, that sounds like a place for me. It was also during the time of the 60s, and I didn't want a traditional education, and Goddard and other progressive schools appealed to me. And I was very interested in the arts, in all of the arts, in music and dance and poetry. And painting. And when I came to Goddard, I had a wonderful poetry teacher named Barry Goldenson, who many other poets have studied with and gone on to write books and become real writers. And then after that, I went to the Iowa Writers Workshop. And then after that, I got a grant at the Radcliffe Institute, which was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they gave me a grant to write for 2 years. Absolutely unbelievable. And there I met Elizabeth Bishop and Robert Lowell and all of the writers who, I think, were writers who were the very important writers of that generation. And there I was, a kind of bystander, younger. And then I got, my first job was at Harvard, and then from there on, I got other jobs, and I wrote my first book while I was in my 20s. It was published when I was 30. Uh-huh. And I've published about a book every 10 years, except for once I published one within maybe 2 or 3 years, and okay. then the same this time with 4 years of each other.
Yeah. Were you always a poet?
I was always a poet. I had no interest in prose. I just didn't know how you could keep that many things in your mind at one time. It just seemed too hard. And I liked, I think because I had listened to all of those songs growing up, mm-hmm. where you basically, the narrative of those songs is they told a little story perfectly within a short amount of time. And it seemed to me that a poem, that's what a poem should do also. Yeah, I never had really an interest. I loved reading prose, but I never wanted to write it. I am very interested in memoir, however, and I think that's much more appealing to me than anything else. And
as a writer, beyond poetry?
Beyond poetry, because my poems, my poems are mainly autobiographical. I also want to try to figure out, how do other people live?
Yeah.
And I think poems, you can get that in poems too.
Uh-huh. Okay. Great. Well, your latest book is That Said, and it's a collection of new and selected poems. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about putting together this collection. And two things I'm interested in are how one goes about choosing poems when you've got a large collection to choose from, and also how do you figure out ordering poems?
Well, I think the answer to all of those questions is that you have to have a very good editor.
Mm-hmm.
And my very good editor is another poet named Michael Collier, who runs Breadloaf.
Breadloaf, sure.
And he was brilliant in helping me figure it out. The main thing, he said, well, why don't you just pick out the poems that you like? Start with that. And so when he saw what I had done, he said, Jane, we are doing a selected poems, not a collected poems. So each of us made our little lists of what we thought, and there were poems I insisted be in there because it wasn't so much as the plot of all of these, but I felt that there was some kind of information that one needed about, because the poems are a narrative, they do tell stories. The other thing is, I studied a lot of other books of selected poems. Some people put their newest poems last and just started chronologically. The poet Stanley Plumlee, whose work I love, suggested that I start with the latest poems and move backwards mm-hmm. and end with the first poems I ever wrote. The problem with that is because they're narrative poems, you had people dying before they were ever born. So that didn't work that well. And I did feel that I did try it. I tried everything just to see what worked. But it was rather daunting. I thought it was going to be easy. It wasn't that easy.
Mm-hmm.
But then also if you had two poems that seemed very similar, either in the way they opened or the way they unfolded or in subject matter, I had to choose the better of the two poems, and often that's where Michael and I got together and said, well, which do you think? So,
although there are thematic lines that run through the book,
yes.
So there are poems that still have certain similar, I would say, inspiration probably.
Absolutely.
Right, yeah.
Yes, they do. Now, the other thing is, he said to me that I didn't have to think of each book the way I thought. I didn't have to think of this whole new book the way I thought of each book, which was each of my books, I thought, told a kind of story. And he said, you're breaking that up now. And you're not, there's no way you can tell that whole story. And these poems will relate to each other, but in different ways
mm-hmm.
than an individual book will relate in the poems in that individual book. And that was very useful, too. It mm-hmm. just opened things up for me, and I didn't feel that I had to be so obsessive about having everything in there.
Yeah, yeah. That must be freeing, in a way, once you accept that and let go and just sort of focus on the ones that you've chosen.
Exactly. And, you know, that's so true. Also, what it means is that There's another poet, Linda Paston, who's a very close friend, and we do poems together once a month when I'm in Washington, D.C. And what she said to me is, because she has 10 books of poems out, and she's basically said to me, you know, this is the book you're going to take with you. This, you're not going to take all your books with you. And this is the book that people are going to have. And if there's a poem you'd absolutely die if it wasn't in that collection, you have to put it in. And so far, not that the book is that old yet, but I haven't really missed anything.
Good, yeah.
I also tried revising poems, early poems, and especially for longer poems, it was a total disaster.
Hmm.
I thought I could revamp them and make them shorter. I saw how long some of them were, and that was terrible. But I thought I could try to re-put them together. It did not work.
Okay.
Did not work at all.
Interesting. So do you think part of that is just that those poems were written by the person you were at that time, and that's not necessarily the person that you are anymore?
I think that's true.
Yeah.
But I also think in terms of the narrative that they were so carefully... I'm a very careful writer, and I revise over and over and over again. And though I try to give the surface a very conversational tone, the poems actually are quite intricately put together. And if you take any one of those little pieces out, sometimes the whole poem just collapses.
Huh. Wow.
So, and yes, it's like I'm not interested in that anymore.
Right, yeah, okay. Well, one of the poems is titled Fortune Cookies, and I wondered if we could start by reading that one, reading that one.
Fortune Cookies. My old boyfriend's fortune cookie read, "Your love life is of interest only to yourself." Not news to me. A famous writer once showed me the fortune in his wallet. "You must curb your lust for revenge," slapped over his dead mother's face. After finishing our Chinese meal at that godforsaken mall, 8 of us crowded around the table, the white tablecloth sopping up islands of spilled soy sauce and beer. The waiter brought tea and oranges sliced into eighths and a plate of fortune cookies. We played our after-dinner game. Each of us sang our line out loud, the chorus adding its coda. "You will meet hundreds of people in bed. Every man is a volume if you know how to read him in bed. You have unusual equipment for success in bed." And those with more delicate sensibilities, new to the group, blushed and checked their wristwatches. We divided up the bill and split. A few left their fortunes behind. The rest slipped those scraps of hope or doom into pockets and pocketbooks to digest later. Maybe one or two of us got lucky that night and had a long and happy life in bed. On the ride home, I absent-mindedly rolled my fortune into a tight coil, the way you roll a joint, and dropped it into my coat pocket. And found it yesterday, oh, how many years later, caught between the stitches of the seam, like one of those notes wedged into a niche of the wailing wall, that someday God might read in bed and change a life.
Thank you for reading that. I really enjoyed that poem. I love God in bed. Another thing I loved about that poem is you don't tell us what your fortune said.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's interesting. I love doing research for poems. So the hardest part of the poem was trying to find good fortunes. And the first the first two fortunes I mentioned, the first about your love life is of interest only to yourself, is a true fortune, which a very narcissistic boyfriend of mine
had.
And I thought it was so perfect. And I remembered that for many years. And then the writer who had You Must Curb Your Lust for Revenge, it's a well-known writer who carried that picture in his wallet over his mother's photograph. And those were two amazing, I thought, wonderful fortunes. But then to find other ones, and I do collect them, but none of them seemed, fantastic. So up until the last minute, I was still looking for some good fortunes.
Mm.
And I think I chose not to do the fortune because it kind of would have given away the whole, like, what could you say, really?
Right.
You know,
right.
There's nothing you could really say.
Well, and suddenly then the fortune would become too important, and it's really not about the actual words on the paper. It's more about the serendipity of the whole experience, maybe?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yes, so I was being withholding.
I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I also noticed in reading the collection that a number of your poems seem interested in fortunes.
Mm-hmm.
And Chinese or not necessarily Chinese. So why do you suppose that might be?
One of my first poems that I believe is in my first book is called Fortune's Pantoum.
And that's in here too, yeah.
And that is a poem where I just literally went to the store and bought several boxes of fortune cookies and broke them open, broke the cookies open, and then set up the fortunes, because they're great one-liners, in an order, in the order of the Pantoum form, which is very specific. And this was before computer, so you couldn't just repeat the line. So I had to try it out many, many different ways. And I did, those were based on real fortunes, except there's one or two sheets that I made. I got them in a book of proverbs, I think. But most of them were, and then I ate the fortune cookies, which at least there was some benefit. It must be the sugar that got me going.
Well, I was actually eventually going to ask you to read Fortune's Pantoum because I also love that it's a pantoum. Do you mind reading that one?
I don't.
Right now, since we're talking about it?
I don't mind at all. What I love about the pantoum form, as you'll hear, it takes maybe two steps forward and one step back, and at the end you pick up the two lines you didn't use that are still hanging there. What I loved about it is when you use the line the first time, it means one thing. But then when it's put next to another line, it suddenly changes its meaning. And for me, the poem was so much fun to write and a little scary because as I was writing it, it seemed as though another darker poem seemed to rise up from under the first poem, a kind of... It just seemed to rise to the surface, and it seemed quite scary to me. So that was the great surprise about writing the poem, that it wasn't just fulfilling the obligations of the form, but that I got something else out of it,
okay,
that I wasn't expecting.